Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour is What Ails America Fixable. When NBC and The Wall Street Journal polled Americans in late June, they asked what I thought was an interesting question. It was worded like this. Do you generally feel that things in the country are? And then the choices were out of control, under control, some of both, not sure. Now, questions like that have been asked before, but what they found was really interesting. 80% of the respondents said they believed things were out of control. Now, that's a remarkable number, even given the pandemic, the racialized police violence, and the protests that we've seen, and the economic recession we're in. But here's what I'm interested in. If so many Americans believe the country is out of control, do they believe that anyone can fix it? Do you? That's what we're talking about this hour. I want you to be on our on-air focus group on this. So here's the question. Do you agree with those Americans who said that things in this country are out of control? And if you do, do you believe a president, a governor, even a mayor, anyone can fix it? Now, this is going to go to our faith in governmental institutions, of course, too. If you believe that the country is out of control, do you believe that a president, a governor, our elected leaders, even a mayor can fix it? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. Do you have faith in governmental institutions to address what ails America? 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. And before I introduce our guests, I'm going to grab a call here from Will in Lakeville. Will, you responded quickly, and I think you have something thoughtful to say about this. So how do you answer this question?
Well, thank you, Carrie, for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I guess I would say I'm in soft agreement with the out-of-control feeling. But I guess I had just kind of two comments. One was that the lack of empathy, caring, and understanding of the present leadership or occupier of the presidency, I think, is a big factor. Mm-hmm. So I guess the opponent candidate at this point, well, maybe not appealing, would definitely bring more caring, understanding, and at least a capability to project some meaningful empathy. Okay. And might make, people feel more comfortable. But I wanted to kind of follow it up by also pointing out the fact that, the coronavirus and, of course, the protests, from the unfortunate deaths of the number of Black Americans certainly plays into it. And my simple point is that as many as 92 million people didn't vote in the last election. Mm-hmm. And basically what that equates to, if you dig down and do the math, only 28% of the people that are registered to vote elected the current leadership. And so we're basically, being governed by the 28%, and it's clear that that's failing. And so I don't think a change in the leadership necessarily means that one person's going to solve it. I think that it means that one person being more caring, empathetic, and understanding is going to put a more, empathetic, caring, and understanding group of people and sub-leadership around
okay.
him.
All right,
so,
good.
Thank you very much.
Some
Have
things
a great morning.
For me to take apart there with our guests, too. Thanks, Will. I appreciate it. So our guests, Philip Chen is with us, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College in Wisconsin. And with us from Madison, Phil, it's really good to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thanks, Carrie. Great to be here.
Leah Wright Rigger is with us, assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and with us today from Hartford, Connecticut. And Leah, I don't know you as well as I know Philip, but I hope I can use your first name and welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Well, it's good to be here.
Philip, I'm curious about what you heard and what Will said. Lack of empathy in from President Trump. And I think there might be something there. Like, does the leader of the country express understanding of what this is like to live through this moment? And does that leave us with the impression that if he doesn't, things are out of control and no one has our backs, I guess, would be the next thought about that. What do you make of it?
So I think that what Will was getting at, I think, is right when he talks about empathy. And I think the closer thing is we think about, you know, we've asked these questions like, who would you rather get a beer with when we talk about presidential candidates? Empathy is kind of one of the things that we sort of ascribe to presidents as something we want. We don't really have a good definition of necessarily what that looks like, but I think absolutely it's true. And it's what we see when from the Biden campaign, right? The Biden campaign is pushing this kind of compassionate, sort of inclusive story about Joe Biden, one of sort of moving away from divisiveness. And I think that that's a key part of the electoral strategy as well. So I think that the Will's right on the money in thinking that that's one of the things that people have criticized President Trump for.
And Leah, how about the not voting? I thought Will's those numbers, and I haven't done a quick stat check here, but they sound about right, about how many of us actually elect the leadership. What does that tell us then about our perceptions that things are out of control?
Well, first, those numbers are actually quite accurate. They're right. They're spot
on.
Wow. About a third. Yeah. So it's not just pretty shocking in terms of, you know, who chooses the president of the United States, but it's also a huge indicator of, you know, just how important non-voters are. We rarely talk about non-voters, even though non-voters have a tremendous amount of power within this larger kind of American body politic, right? So the non-voters are actually someone or a group that we should be studying in depth to figure out, you know, why aren't they voting? Why aren't they participating? Now, one of the things that we say at various, you know, at policy schools is the sign of a healthy democracy is high turnout, right, in terms of voting. One of the signs of an unhealthy democracy is really low turnout. So we should actually be deeply alarmed, because part of what non-voters are telling us is that they are deeply frustrated with essentially the failures of the American state. So I think part of what's happening right now is that we're seeing that play out in part with all of these people, 80% of Americans polled, who are saying that they're deeply frustrated with the state of the country, right? Like this country is in chaos. But part of what they're also seeing is that they're deeply frustrated with the ways in which elected officials, public institutions, public policies have consistently failed the American people. And so that translates a lot, oftentimes, into frustration with American democracy, and it translates into not voting. And what ends up happening is that you have the same people, this small, very small group of people, choosing who our elected officials, who our elected leaders are going to be, and therefore transforming again, you know, making decisions around policies that ultimately don't affect the American public for the greater good.
You know, I have to say, Leah, we've done many shows on voting, and we've heard from many people who decide not to vote, but I've never thought about how influential that cohort of non-voters are. I mean, they are exerting a lot of influence on the way this political system exists. Never really considered how much influence. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things to really hone in on with non-voters is that many of them feel disempowered, even though they are exerting a powerful act, right? And so this is, you know, some of it is suppression, right? They can't get access to the polls. But a lot of it is also alienation and feeling like the American two-party system doesn't actually speak to their needs, to their wants, to, you know, the most pressing issues in their lives. And what's remarkable to me is that most politicians, with the exception of a carefully cultivated few, most politicians simply just don't care about those non-voters.
Right, right.
But what we've seen with something like the New Georgia Voter Project, which is Stacey Abrams' project in Georgia, is that there are some politicians who understand that if you can get to those non-voters, if you can get to unlikely voters, you can actually shift and transform what the political electorate looks like. And that's actually, you know, the forefront of democracy. We should be looking out to all of those people who aren't voting and saying, why aren't you voting? And what can we do to get you into the process? That's what's critical.
Lisa says on Twitter, yes, things are out of control. Yes, it's fixable if we lean on scientists, data, and the greatest minds in the country who are qualified to solve our problems. This administration is leading us further into chaos. I just want to note for listeners who think, well, yeah, those numbers, they probably track along with partisanship. Take note of these numbers. Yes, a high majority of Democrats and independents said things are in the country are out of control. 66% of Republicans said the same thing. So this comes from a June NBC Wall Street Journal poll. There's a lot of interesting numbers in there. This hour, we are talking about whether you agree with many Americans who believe that things in the country are out of control. And if you agree with that, I guess I'm asking you this morning, with the guidance of our guests, whether you believe government leaders, government institutions can solve what ails America. Are you one of those voters who basically sit out the political process, as Leah is talking about this morning? Have you just decided, I can't change it, I'm not going to be involved? I mean, how do you hear our conversation developing this morning? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, to Cole in Ely. Cole, I am so glad a teacher called. I was hoping for that. So good. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you so much for delving into this. I'm not just a teacher. I'm a civics education consultant.
Terrific.
That's trying to reintegrate. Well, but I'm a spinach salesman in effect, so I need all the butter I can get. So
okay.
To address the question, A, I'm going to ask that everybody turn the binoculars around and the TV off. It's not up to the elected leaders to do this. It's up to us, the citizens. It's our society. We select leaders, or as you just pointed out, we probably don't. We just fall into that. Aristotle had the idea that the most powerful office in a democracy was that of citizen, because it is an indefinite scope and indefinite term. If we're getting used to simply watching democracy as a cable service, mm-hmm. and expecting it to be provided, don't be surprised if it isn't. It is an integral and active way you manifest love for your country and one another. Is civil society is not up to the elected officials. It's up to us. And if we don't teach civics, and among other things, you're basically expecting people to do algebra, picking leaders, without teaching basic math. The toolkit should start in kindergarten, and so our kids can learn to live together, love together, and go forward without fear. Because that's what it does, is we're supposed to pay our leaders based upon our character. And if we've decided simply to sit home and watch, well, here we are. Let's try what we used to do before TV and the rest of it, is connect with your neighbors, connect with everybody, keep an open heart, that we'll all move forward together.
Cole, a lot to talk about there. I really appreciate the call, and I want to come back to Phil Chen. Philip, we had to clarify your connection there. Are we better? Good. Much better.
I believe we're better.
Okay, good. So while we were doing that, Leah was talking to us about how influential non-voters are, how much power mm-hmm. they exert over the process, and then we take Cole, who basically makes that point again from a civics point of view. What can you say about that?
So I think that from a sheer number standpoint, it's absolutely correct. Non-voters are a major piece of the puzzle when we're thinking about who gets elected in this country. And I think civic education is important, but I think we perhaps miss a broader point if we focus purely on people choosing not to vote. Yes, I think that is part of it, but there's also significant other barriers that the U.S. puts in place. And so when we think about non-voters, we have to think about both the sort of civic education role, getting people involved and interested and aware of politics and able to make those decisions. But also we should think about what are the limitations that we put in place that keep people from voting. So the fact that So we know that non-voters don't look like voters, right? Non-voters are tend to be younger. They tend to be less educated. The things that we kind of know about non-voters. So it's not just random. It's not about choice entirely. So I think
Phil,
that's absolutely correct.
I mean, forgive me here. We're getting kind of a piercing beeping on your line. We're going to have to try to work on this again. I am sorry. I was so excited you could do the show. We'll try to clear out the technical issues here. All right. We'll call you back. Phil Chen is with us when we can solve some of these technical issues. He's an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College in Wisconsin. And Leah Wright Rigger is with us. She's the Harry S. Truman Professor of American History at Brandeis and an associate professor of public policy at the Kennedy School. And we're having a conversation this morning, if you've just gotten into it, about how Americans feel about whether the country is under control and whether we believe that our government institutions can solve it, and whether the fact that so many of us, as has been said by our guests and by our callers, basically observe our democracy from a distance, and that's part of the reason that we don't have a hand in how our government institutions work and why we, the level of trust for government institutions is at an all-time low. How do you feel about it? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieMPR to Al in Minneapolis. Hey, Al, how are you?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
A comment is that I think a lot of people are sitting out because it seems to me that the political system has kind of been manipulated to favor those that have most wealth to keep their wealth. And I think that's really causing a lot of problems from people. But to your point today, I mean, we have a lot of very good and a history of very good, competent, compassionate leaders in this state. I mean, you got Frazier in Minneapolis, Sales Belton. You got Wendell Anderson.
Hubert Humphrey. Yeah.
Hubert Humphrey, and people who thought broadly about making the country and the community and the state function well for everybody. I always thought that was the whole point of policy analysis, was to look at how your policy was going to affect everybody in the community and then help rebalance. If some people were going to benefit greatly, then maybe there should be some way to take some of that benefit from them and put it to the people that were going to be harmed by the process.
Yeah, so you're looking at the economic piece of this, and I'm glad because we haven't really delved into that yet. Leah, I want to read something that journalist George Packer has written about, which I think goes to what Al was suggesting here. And he is a critic of President Trump's. He's arguing that this virus appeared when many Americans were slowly accepting how inequitable our capitalist society is. And he writes in The Atlantic, "This was the American landscape that lay open to the virus. In prosperous cities, a class of globally connected desk workers dependent on a class of precarious and invisible service workers. In the countryside, decaying communities in revolt against the modern world. On social media, mutual hatred and endless vituperation among different camps." Does he have something here about we have long been observing the inequity in our economic system here, and then in comes the virus, and we are seeing the people that are on the lower end of the way our economic system is set up being hurt by this even more deeply? What would you say about that?
I think that the timing of the virus exposed so much of what we as a nation were really, you know, in the throes of having conversations around. And I say that, and I want to be particular about this, because I don't think these conversations are new conversations. We can actually go back and look at a moment like Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. right? 2010, 2011, that era, where there are mass protests, a very short amount of protests, but the protests that happen are rather large and rather startling across the country. But it's a moment where people are saying, wait a second, there is rampant inequality, right? Coming off the heels or coming off the tail of the 2008-2009 downturn.
Right.
So the American economy and various protesters, but particularly young white protesters, are saying, look, enough is enough. 99%, right? The 99% versus the 1%. Now, that movement kind of dies off or dries up a little bit, or so we think. But one of the things that we notice is that it gets picked up in other places. It gets picked up by the labor movement. It gets picked up through economic movements. It gets picked up by the Bernie Sanders campaign. It even in some ways gets picked up in terms of rhetorical flourishes by somebody like Donald Trump
right, right.
In 2016. And so we begin to have this really big conversation in some quarters that's really quite deep. But then here comes coronavirus that exposes it and lays it bare, right? There's absolutely no escaping it. And one of the things that, you know, that I think we can point out is one of the reasons that the protests that emerge in the aftermath of George Floyd are so explosive and so globally big is because it is directly connected to the ways in which the coronavirus, COVID-19, exposes an economic inequality and the failures of the state. So it's not simply that, you know, George Floyd is killed by police officers. It's also that George Floyd is in Minneapolis because he's looking for work, because he's underemployed and unemployed, much like the rest, you know, a good portion of the economy. He's part of this group that has been harmed by both the coronavirus, but also the disparities that are built into the system that COVID-19 has exposed for everyone to see. And then the last thing that I'll say with this is that COVID-19 makes it impossible for us to look away because we are all quarantined and we're all socially isolated. So we can't distract ourselves from the conversation. Now it's exposed bare for us, but we also can't turn away from it.
And Phil, I would add to this, I'd love to hear what you would add to what Leah is saying here, but I just have to add this dissonance of an often rising stock market, even in the midst of this pandemic, with an unemployment rate around 11%, and all this celebration of what's happening with the stock market, and I guess less of a true nuanced conversation about what to do about the kind of quality of jobs that are or are not coming back. So what else would you say?
So I think that Leah's spot on, right? I think this is about the confluence of events, right? The confluence of the coronavirus pandemic, the confluence of George Floyd's murder and the protests around that. I think what you're hinting at, right, is the inequality that has been built into our system. Now, the one thing I will say is I don't think that the vast majority of your average voters think about sort of the protests as sort of a continuation in the same sort of nuanced way around the coronavirus pandemic. But I definitely think that they're connected in people's minds, and they're connected through uncertainty. They're connected through this sort of generalized statement about whether things are out of control. All of this is part of sort of the psychological makeup of what people are feeling right now. And mm-hmm. So I think that that's a really important point to think about, you know, when we say, well, why were the protests around George Floyd's death so expansive and moved so widely? Well, part of it has to do with, like Leah said, that he was in Minneapolis looking for work, but it's also because people are feeling uncertain already, and it's another piece of that sort of uncertainty that's being built into there.
So here's the thing that I find interesting about what you've just said, Philip, that, you know, those protests were also demanding accountability from our institutions. And I've suggested a couple times in this show that there has been a long diminishing trust of Americans for our institutions. And yet those protests were saying these institutions exist and we're demanding accountability. For all of our cynicism, perhaps we trust government institutions in a way that at first blush we say we don't. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think I kind of do. I mean, I think what maybe if I can sort of rephrase what you're saying,
yeah,
is that the average, the general public
doesn't exhibit sort of generalized trust. When we say, do you trust, you know, the people in Washington? Do you trust your state government?
Right.
We don't see high levels there. But we also, we see that people have still some underlying faith that the institutions can be fixed. Is that perhaps what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And maybe that is a, well, there's nowhere else to turn. But that, you know, that in a way that gives me hope that that number of people with those great of an expression of something has to change and calls for accountability redound right back to some of these institutions that we say, I've given up. They can't be fixed. But, you know, we.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think what we often think about is sort of generalized trust and specific trust.
Right.
And I think maybe what we're seeing is we've seen a long history of reduced specific trust in institutions, in Congress, in the presidency. The presidency is a little bit odd because it's a single individual from a party, but Congress consistently is ranked low. We're seeing low specific trust in police departments, things like that. But people still have sort of this generalized trust. And, you know, when we ask people about trust in their fellow Americans, right, trust in other people, we see much higher levels of trust, not, you know, maybe how we would hope to see, but still higher levels. And so I think that's maybe where you're drawing some of this hope, is that people haven't given up on society in general.
I think that's right.
They may have given up on the people or the makeup of our institutions and feel the need to change them, but they haven't moved to, well, let's just go to anarchy and remove all institutions. It's the generalized trust still remains a little bit.
Let me grab a call from Desdemona in Roseville. Hey, Desdemona, glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am hoping that I would love to say to the next president, and I'm hoping it will be a different president, that he should hire and recruit and appoint it to positions in his cabinet and his government at least half of the people that would be not white and not male, because we have so many people that are not white and not male that are capable and appropriate to hire in these positions, people with experience and knowledge. And I think that America, oh, and also gender-wise, to also gender, what word am I looking for? Gender open, trans, gay people as well, to bring those into the government as well, as all races being reflected in our government. And I think our people would look at the government and say, yes, that reflects me. I want to be involved in my government. I believe in my country. And they would be, their needs and wants and desires would be reflected in how our country is governed.
Good. We'll take that up on the other side of news, Desdemona. I appreciate the call. If you've tuned in, we're having this conversation with Philip Chen. He's an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, and Leah Wright Rigger, a professor of American history at Brandeis University. And we're hearing from you about whether you agree with this sensibility that things in the country feel out of control. Yes. I mean, we're in the midst of an economic recession and a pandemic and an election, which is why I thought this was an interesting conversation to have. And if you do, whether you trust government institutions to fix it, and how you participate or don't in this democracy. Now, really full phone lines here. I'd love to hear from you when you can get in. 651-227-6000, anywhere in the upper Midwest, 800-242-2828. And if you're on Twitter, it's at @CarrieMPR. I want to talk with our guests on the other side of news about what Desdemona brought up. I also want to ask them about what the corrosive impact, the corrosive effect of grievance politics is on our democratic body here, on we the people. And right to the phones to Dominic in Anoka. Hey, Dominic, thanks so much for waiting through the newscast. Much appreciated. What are you thinking about this?
Yeah, what I think is, I'm originally from Southern Africa.
Uh-huh.
And I strongly believe that unless in America there is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as happened in South Africa, which killed apartheid, there's not going to be peace in the United States until that happens. Because this dates back to the beginning of slavery. Mm-hmm. As far back as that, 401 years or something like that, when slavery was taking place and there was no consideration of a black person as a human being. It's about humanity. And what I believe, the African philosophy of Ubuntu states that no human being can survive alone, which goes back to we the people. And we the people are the people that are supposed to sort this out, because the African philosophy I'm talking about says no person can survive on their own, which means a person is a person because of other people. Nelson Mandela requested Bishop Desmond Tutu to start a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That took some maybe 2 years almost before it was finally finished. But it's the one that killed the evil apartheid system, which had the same kind of hate and inequities, just like the systemic injustices in this world that are happening in the United States.
I'm really glad you introduced this into the conversation. So, Leah, this idea of a specific infrastructure, right, an intentional infrastructure for resolving much of what we're protesting about and much of what is feeding this perception that there is something wrong that is difficult to fix. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's really important to remember about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa is that it had the full power and enforcement of the federal government, their South African government behind it, and it had peace. So one of the things that we are seeing in the United States is that there's been a huge push, and this is not a new push, but it's been revived in the last couple of weeks for a Truth and Reconciliation. Some people are calling it Truth, Reconciliation, and Justice Commission. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is hovering around ideas of conversations where you can say, you've done this past harm to me, or let's show you how this harm has occurred. The problem is that in a lot of ways, in the United States, would be symbolic. You know, when we think about, say, John Conyers introducing H.R. 40, which is a bill to study the need for a commission on reparations, for 40 years straight, he was shot down on this, right? So I think part of what we're seeing is that there's a real struggle, and unless the federal government puts its full weight behind it and then follows it up with concrete solutions, right, that they then enact, what you're really going to be having is just more conversations, symbolic conversations around the same thing. So, and I'll say one other thing. You know, a lot of people will say, well, we can't do this because we've never done this before. That's not actually true. We've had a number of commissions and conversations around this, which have resulted in action. But most notably, we've done it in the aftermath of slavery with a radical reconstruction, right, for 8+ years, where the federal government put its full weight behind policies, procedures, actions, because they understood that in order to change the nation, they have to incorporate a population into the body politic, but also rectify past wrongs. So we do have a blueprint. We have a roadmap. The question is, will our elected officials, our political institutions strong enough? Historically, the change has come from people on the ground pushing and pushing and pushing. So in order to see that, we do need people on the ground to continue protesting, to continue working with elected officials, to continue pushing from the bottom up.
Phil, what do you think? Are we strong enough, confident enough? Are our government institutions brave enough to do the kinds of things that Leah and Dominic are describing?
I mean, unfortunately, no, I don't think we are. I don't think that there's nearly a consensus within the federal government to put exactly what Leah says and is true, what is needed, which is power and consequences and power behind something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I think we've seen that it will likely become partisan. It will likely have detractors, and without a sort of national movement. So that's the, you know, that's why when you look at things like the NBC poll with, you know, 81% of Democrats saying they're more concerned about George Floyd's death than the protests, right? You probably need those kinds of numbers across partisan differences, but we only see 29% of Republicans saying they're more concerned about George Floyd's death than the protests around it. Without some kind of national unity, you're not going to see, I think, the people and the institutions get behind something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That's not to say that it's not important or needed. I think moving towards these sort of restorative justice models can be really important. But without some kind of enforcement, you run the risk. You know, Canada tried to do this with their Truth and Reconciliation Commission, haven't seen nearly as much sort of movement policy-wise, although it's starting to, you know, it's largely symbolic, like Leah said. So I think I'm not sure we have the sort of national consensus, especially among our institutions, to see something like this at the current time.
Listener on Twitter here says, I love your discussion this morning. It's my hope that people realize the power voters have over these institutions. It's a government of the people, by the people, for the people. If we participate in the process, we control the outcome. To the phones here to Renee in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Renee.
Hi. So I guess I have a couple of comments. And the first would be that I don't think, and I wouldn't have said this just even a few years ago, that our government is working well. I think a lot of problems have been exposed, and I'm not sure that the leaders that we have currently in place are going to be able to turn this ship around. And I believe that they kind of serve their own purpose, mm-hmm. and there's too much money in politics and the special interests, and that's why people feel disenfranchised and the government's not working for them. And so I'm not for sure that the leaders we have now can get this done, especially to the extent to which it needs to happen, because they're worried about their next election. But I do find it shocking that Washington really did predict, like, some of this stuff, that he specifically addressed the people's special interests, or he kind of referred to them, I think, as regional interests, and that outside country actors being involved in some of the interests or pushing differences amongst us. If now it's like we're exposed as this kind of dysfunctional family. And so, but one of the things that I have been curious about is because it's so shocking to me how divisive everything is. I mean, even like the most basic issue can be turned into some political issue, and
right,
how far
right.
apart people are. And what they say is so shocking, and these are my neighbors or classmates or whatever. And so it makes me wonder, was I naive and that was always there? Or is this something that that because our leaders are also act this way, are they acting on our behalf? Or was it always
good question.
And it was always there? Or are they part of the problem because they are working on this?
I think I have it, Renee. As in, do our politicians reflect who we are? Are they leading us or following us? Leah, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think there is some good scholarship, and I'm sure Philip can maybe provide some insight on this, but there's some good scholarship about Congress elected officials, whether they lead or they follow, and how that connects, for example, to their concerns around re-election. And that they do have the ability to actually lead, and that oftentimes their constituents will follow them through difficult areas. But then oftentimes they're very concerned that if they do something or step outside the mold, that in fact their constituents will abandon them.
It's
kind of a complex, I think, subject. But I think one of the things I wanted to highlight about what the caller has just said, and several callers have kind of brought up in the remarks, is, you know, saying, has it always been this way, or is this something new?
Right.
And I think one of the things that the moment right now, and just how we're being essentially pummeled from every single side, one of the things that it's highlighted is that democracy has not been working as envisioned for a great swath of our country, whether it be through disenfranchisement, as what mentioned earlier, whether it be through civil rights and second-class citizenship, you know, if we're talking about indigenous populations, if we're talking about African-American populations or black populations or Latino populations. And that what a lot of people are now seeing is actually what many people in this country have been experiencing for generations. But what I would also say here is that one of our greatest abilities or one of the greatest promises of democracy is that these people that have been excluded and marginalized from the democratic process have done great work in moving the democratic process forward. So when we see democratic change happen, like positive, progressive democratic change, it often comes from the pushing and the movement and the protest of the people who have been excluded. So when we see these protests that are happening right now, right, where people are labeling and essentially saying, well, this is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we should be optimistic about is that they are pushing to make this country more democratic for everyone. So they are essentially engaging in the civic process, even though they have been excluded from it for so long.
Yeah. And Phil, this is why I wanted to bring up the idea of white grievance politics, too, how that is influencing the way we see some of these movements and the possibility for change.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, with what Lee is saying, I think absolutely we have to think about the way that our system has been misrepresenting or failing to represent significant portions of our population, and that in many ways the protests are a result not just of a very visible killing of another black man by the police, but also of decades and centuries of a lack of representation, and that it's just a sort of a reiteration of that. That if there were strong faith in the institutions to represent interests, you probably wouldn't see protests. You would see
movements
through traditional political participation channels. Joe Soss at the University of Minnesota had a great he gave testimony to the State House committee who was looking at the protest, and he gave this fantastic piece of testimony about the fact that it's about a lack of representation or a feeling of non-representation. But getting to that idea of grievance, of sort of white grievance politics, I think we often think about it as white identity politics in the terms of Ashley Jardina's book.
Yes.
But regardless, I think what you're seeing is, in many ways, it's a political or an electoral strategy to mobilize base voters, right? It's that we know that there's not sort of statistics to support this idea that, you know, of sort of a zero-sum racial game, but that's still a useful electoral strategy. And so I think that it's absolutely playing into this at this point, and it's bringing out some more of these divisions between partisan groups or supporters on both sides.
Yeah. You know, as I was thinking about the arc of this conversation, I was remembering about some of the things that then candidate Obama was talking about and the kind of response that he got in 2008 and where we are today. This is just a campaign blast from the past to listen to the kind of rhetoric that a lot of Americans responded to back then.
But this campaign that we're running is not about me. It's about you. It's about your hopes and your dreams and what you will do. Because there are few obstacles that can withstand the power of millions of voices calling for change. That's how change has always happened, not from the top down, but from the bottom up. And that's exactly how you and I will change this country.
Philip, how did we go from that to this? And yes, I know there's been a lot of time in between and a lot of water under that bridge, but it feels like such a whiplash.
I think it's absolutely a whiplash. And I think a lot of that has to do with what Barack Obama represented to both the Democratic and Republican parties,
mm-hmm.
and the responses of the parties to his election. And so we have to remember 2008 was a very, obviously, as you said, it's a very different time. And if you look at the work of, say, Tesla and Sears, they find that the much of the support for Barack Obama could be traced essentially to sort of symbolic racial support, mm-hmm. That among Democrats who were liberal on racial issues, there wasn't really a much policy difference between the major candidates, between Obama, Clinton, and Edwards. There wasn't a huge policy difference. And so you could symbolically support a black man running for president and not really sacrifice policy all that much. And so we've moved from that time to these intense reactions to Barack Obama, the 2010 election and the Tea Party movement. And it's all couched in this idea of sort of pushing back against change. But also there's an undercurrent of racial politics, right? There's an undercurrent of racial resentment, of white identity, and all of that is now played into sort of what you're saying, this whiplash, this movement away from sort of this politics of change and sort of the bipartisan or, you know, cross-racial coalition that Obama talked about in 2008 to a much more sort of divided partisan and racially divided politics that we see today.
Yeah. Let me grab one last call here from Kat in Hudson. Hi, Kat. I have about a couple minutes here, but I wanted to hear from you. What are you thinking about?
Well, this is just something that was a really, yay, I love to see that type moment. I was coming home from up north yesterday, and in the small town of Siren, Wisconsin, there was a group, it couldn't have been more than maybe a dozen of white, mostly young people, holding Black Lives Matter signs up. So somehow we are getting this awareness even into small town, very conservative America. And if they get out and vote, we could see a really nice social change in our country.
What, well, Leah, what do you think with 2 minutes left here?
Sure, 2 minutes. I'll just say that.
You know, and to be continued.
Yeah, to be continued. One of the most optimistic things that I can say right now about the protests that we're seeing is that they're multiracial protests. Mm-hmm. And in the past, while we've seen protests and we've seen protest movements, very rarely have these kind of movements been multiracial movements. We now have data that shows that the movement for Black Lives, these protests that we've seen just in the last 7 weeks alone, are the largest mass protests in modern American history.
Wow.
That is cause for optimism, because it means we're on the cusp of not simply symbolic change, which I would also point to, you know, elected officials, we can couch in that like language of symbolic change, but we are on the cusp of transformative concrete change, because it tells us that there is a multiracial movement emerging and a multiracial movement that is demanding concrete steps and a very different vision of America. So they are actually putting things in place and pushing for this idea of, say, holding government accountable, holding officials accountable, holding institutions accountable, and doing it across racial groups, class lines, gender lines, and all of the above.
I'm making a note to gather us again together in late September, early October to continue the conversation. Leah, thank you so much for being part of this. Really good to have you.
Just a pleasure. Thank you.
And Philip, always, always grateful for your time. Thank you. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Always happy to be here.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.